Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. CAP Radio's financial troubles go beyond the public radio station. As a nonprofit auxiliary of Sacramento State, any debt is ultimately the responsibility of the university. Filing for bankruptcy is not an option, which means Sac State is tethered to CAP Radio's deep-rooted financial mismanagement that was uncovered following an audit commissioned by the California State University System. That audit found numerous instances of financial mismanagement, as well as concern that CAP Radio would not be able to pay for its long-delayed and costly downtown projects, which include a new headquarters and live venue. And according to Sac State's own internal projections, CAP Radio will have no financial resources remaining in January of 2024. These devastating findings touch so many lives, from staff at CAP Radio who are finding out about this just like everyone else, to listeners and supporters, as well as the Sac State campus community. As journalists, we've been reporting on this independently, which means in following NPR's protocols for reporting on itself, no CAP Radio corporate official or news executive reviewed our reporting before broadcast. So we're going to continue our ongoing coverage today with a focus on students. Natalie Andrade Dominguez is Sacramento State's student body president with Associated Students, Inc., or ASI, and is also a CAP Radio board member. Natalie, welcome.
Hi, Vicky. Thank you so much for having me.
So I want to start with what's new and work our way backward, because this is a quickly developing situation. What is your involvement with the CAP Radio board?
So I currently serve on the board since this summer. So I've been a part of the board for 3 months, and before that, I had no involvement with the board internally. However, with ASI, we do have an internship that's supposed to be a partnership that I was actually supposed to oversee last year, which did not happen. So knew of Capital Public Radio, but just joined the board this summer.
And that internship program was supposed to be affiliated with CAP Radio?
Yes, and did not happen.
When it comes to a board, I mean, when you and I were talking and preparing for this conversation, you know, you have been part of other boards. I mean, can you just give us a better understanding of what a board is supposed to do?
Yes, so I currently do serve as ASI president, which is usually affiliated as being student body president, but I also am president and CEO of ASI, which is a campus auxiliary. So very similar to how CPR is a campus auxiliary as well. So ASI has its own board, and I essentially am the president of that board. And I am also a part of three other boards on campus, which are also campus auxiliaries. So I am heavily involved with how campus auxiliary works, how boards are supposed to be ran, procedures, policies, and serve mainly as a student representative on all of these boards. And essentially what these campus auxiliaries are intended to do are to serve the students and the Sac State community in conjunction with the board members and how we can best serve our Sac State community and its students.
And that is really important context, because that brings me to just Monday. You sent a statement to the State Hornet, which is the student-run news service, and you called on the CAP Radio board members to resign. Can you explain what led for you to release that statement?
Absolutely. So there is a few things. So one being that me knowing the knowledge of how boards are supposed to work, there was a few procedural things that did not sit right with me as being a member of a lot of other boards and seeing that this board was not following those. So one being that there was no agenda posted, and to parliamentary procedures, there has to be an agenda posted 72 hours in advance. So there was no agenda that was posted. The modality of the meeting was they were trying to switch it. So I got an email saying that it was going to be on Zoom a day before, that it was going to be in person, and then the night before that it was going to be back on Zoom. We cannot do that per parliamentary procedures, because we are a campus auxiliary and open to the public and a nonprofit status. We have to notify the public how our meetings are going to be ran, when they're going to be ran. And if we want to have a closed session, that still has to be a public meeting. And then it can be notified that we will go into closed session. But the public has to have an opportunity to come and give public comment. So that was really the groundwork for me to put out a statement as quickly as I did, because we had a board meeting on Tuesday, and us not following those parliamentary procedures, to me personally, and also serving as a president of another campus auxiliary, that was not okay. So the leadership in CPR, that they are not following those standard guidelines that we need to, really called for me to put a statement out as fast as I did.
And when you're talking about the last board meeting, that was just yesterday.
Yes.
And from my understanding, was it supposed to be public, but then it became a closed session?
All board meetings from all campus auxiliaries are public. They need to be public. If we want to have a closed session, absolutely we can, per parliamentary policies. We can have a closed session. However, our board meetings need to be notified, or the public needs to be notified that we have a board meeting and that it, at this time, from this time to this time, we're having closed session. That it was only stated on the website that we're having a meeting on Tuesday and that the entire meeting was a closed session. That cannot happen. There is no agenda. There is no stating of if it was the modality, if it was going to be on person or in Zoom. So it was just a lot of parliamentary procedures that were not being followed.
And even though this is your first term as president, you've been with ASI, with the student, it's an elected student body government, for 3 years prior. So you have a good familiarity with how things are supposed to work. When you first became a student representative of the CAP Radio Board just a few months ago, I mean, what can you share about how the process has been? Because you were walking into to all of this. I mean, I'm sure it was largely unknown to you.
Yeah, so my first board meeting, they had, we had not known the extent of the financial issues. I found out just as everyone else did. So when I heard that there was a bit of financial issues, of course, that always comes to a concern. And then knowing the extent of the audit, I can't even imagine, I can't even explain my shock to it. My own campus auxiliary just had our audit, and it was completely clean, and it's been for years. So seeing the comparison and how we follow very strictly the CSU policies and how we need to do things, and then seeing how bad it got at CPR, that raised a red flag for me as a new board member, as not knowing prior history of really not knowing what internally has gone on with the board, someone who's coming in new and seeing the amount of debt that they are in, it raised a huge flag, because how does that go on for so long? So it wasn't sitting right with me in the beginning. And then as I read the audit and I continued to hear things, the reaction of the board, it was just all red flags that were occurring to me. And as someone who knows and has been in those positions, I knew that I had to say something before it got worse.
What response have you received since issuing that statement calling on the board to resign?
From the student perspective, I mean, students are happy. They've told me that they're glad that they have someone speaking up. If I'm being completely transparent, the students are lost. They have no idea what's going on. They don't know how campus auxiliaries work. They don't even know what an auxiliary means. They didn't even know CPR was a part of Sac State.
And CPR is Capital Public Radio.
Yes.
Just so listeners are aware.
Yes. I'm used to just saying CPR.
Oh, I get it.
So students don't know anything. They don't know what this audit meant. They don't know how it was going to affect Sac State. All in their mind is they see Sac State is in debt or has to pay this amount of money. And they're worried that that money now is going to pull from resources on Sac State campus. So to me, that was my call out of saying, OK, students don't know what's going on. I need to speak out as a representative.
You know, and this just follows, you know, across the CSU system, the Board of Trustees within the Cal State University system approved on tuition increases. So I'm thinking about, you know, the confusion that you're explaining from the student community. I mean, they're finding out that come next academic year, there's going to be an increase in tuition coupled with these financial challenges.
Yeah, so that raises a lot more concern in the students. They're not only worried of how they're going to pay tuition next year, how they're going to get that money, but then Sac State is all over the news saying, oh my God, we owe this much money to them. They don't understand the logistics of actually what's going on and how it will not affect them deeply. But they don't know that. No one's talking to them. No one's explaining things to them in a language that they will understand. So that was my call out, that I need to put something out and talk to the students of what's going on and letting them know, like, we are not going to let this affect them. And we're going to work towards bringing back Capital Public Radio's mission and ensuring that in the future, we can have a connection with Sac State students and this amazing organization and all the work that you all do.
Yeah, because when getting to that mission, I mean, the audit also detailed that, you know, we are to be, as an auxiliary, of course, a benefit to the campus, which means a benefit to the students. And we haven't had students part of CAP Radio since the pandemic. I believe they suspended the internship program, but it hasn't been brought back. How would you like to see CAP Radio move forward as a benefit to the student community, let's say like 6 months to a year from now?
I mean, first responsibility is to ensure that we are financially stable. And when doing that, ensuring that we can bring back that internship program, because it is so valuable for students who want to go into the media world, who are seeking to do what you are doing, to do what all the work that you all do here. So it's important that we reestablish an internship program and that you all are able to have student assistants, that they can shadow you all and hopefully have a connection to pursue a career here, which is very important. We have a lot, especially because we're in Sacramento and the politics around Sacramento. A lot of people go into political journalism, they go into communications, and we don't have that established connection in it. And students have asked me, like, is there internships? What's going on? And for us to be able to say, no, we don't have anything, the mission is to be able to say, yes, we do have this internship program.
Hmm. Given that Sacramento State and CAP Radio are tethered together, we're an auxiliary of the university should also provide oversight to CAP Radio, too. I mean, CAP Radio has been around for more than four decades. Do you hold any responsibility to those in leadership at Sac State about letting things get to this point?
I don't know much of before this process and how much involvement the university has had, so I won't speak on anything I don't know. But moving forward, I do think that the university has a responsibility to have oversight over Capital Public Radio until they are financially stable and get a new general manager and president who can take over the leadership responsibility once Capital Public Radio is financially stable.
I want to get to the search for the general manager because Sacramento State sent us a statement last night because the board meeting was a closed session. Sacramento State opposes the board's move to vote to hire a GM. And their first sentence in the statement they sent us was that the university had been notified that Capital Public Radio's vote this evening, that was Tuesday evening, to move forward with hiring a new general manager at the cost of nearly $500,000. I mean, you are representative on the board. I mean, hearing that, what is your reaction to moving forward with this hire?
I agree with Sac State's statement. I voted no against hiring the new GM and general manager for Capital Public Radio because there is no funds. How can we move forward with hiring someone when we don't know where the funds will come from? I think that's financially irresponsible. And I think the first step is, I mean, we have Tom Carlo, who has years of experience in public media, and allowing him with that experience, with his connections with Sac State, with President Wood, to rebuild and help the financial issues that Capital Public Radio is having. And then further down the line, see who we can hire, who can permanently be the general manager and president, so they don't come into this issue that we're having here. And I agree with Sac State's statement, and I think it's not the right call.
Yeah, and when I want to clarify with the cost of, that Sac State says, of nearly $500,000 a year, a salary for what could be the new GM for CAP Radio that the board voted to approve yesterday, that includes benefits as well. Finally, I mean, in that same statement, Sacramento State also said, quote, "We also believe in saving CAP Radio." And I see you nodding along as well. I mean, what is a sound and healthy CAP Radio to you?
To me, that we're following its mission, that we're serving our listeners, we're serving the community, the Sac State community, the city community, everyone who supports and loves Capital Public Radio. And the students, that there is a strong connection there. I mean, we're missing a key part, that CPR is a campus auxiliary. And we need to be in connection with Sac State students. All I have heard throughout the students is we don't even know what that is. They do not know. They didn't even know that this station was on Sac State campus. So there's a huge disconnect there between this campus auxiliary and the students. Even my own board members didn't even know about Capital Public Radio. I was the only person on my board who knew what was going on. So not even the own student government leadership that is supposed to represent all 33,000 students knew what was going on. I can't imagine the average student who isn't as involved. So that clearly shows that there is a disconnect between this auxiliary and the students. And to get to a point where students know about the opportunities here and that there are opportunities mm-hmm. here and that CPR is thriving and that they are doing their mission, which is serving the community and the students.
You have deep-rooted knowledge of what is just is such a dire situation. And this is my final question. Knowing all that you know, are you hopeful that CAP Radio can get to that point?
I am very hopeful. I think under our new president, President Luke Wood, he has shown such a passion and desire to ensure that we keep Capic Public Radio and that we bring it back to its mission. And I full-heartedly believe we can get there. I think with taking the right steps, which is why I called for the resignation as quickly, which is why I'm voicing my concerns, because I want it to get back there.
Did the board talk to you about that? Because, I mean, you have to work with them.
No. I mean, it was a closed session, so I can't talk much of discussion, but I was in agreement with what Sac State chooses to do.
Natalie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Vicky.
Natalie Andrade Dominguez is Sacramento State's student body president with Associated Students EEC, or ASI, and is also a CAP Radio board member, sharing her perspective on the deep-rooted financial mismanagement issues uncovered in a CSU audit. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It has been 10 years from the Here We Stay movement to the Light the Beam movement. It has been just a wild ride for the Sacramento Kings, their loyal fans, and the city of Sacramento. You may remember it was 10 years ago, a single tweet from a Seattle food blogger kicked off a fight between Sacramento and Seattle over the Kings. The team was suddenly and shockingly for sale. Would Sacramento be able to find a buyer and keep the team? Or would the NBA allow a new owner to move our beloved Kings to Seattle? This coming Sunday, KCRA3 will air a documentary called Game On, Fight for the Kings. It is a behind-the-scenes look at all of the twists and the turns of how Sacramento managed to keep the Kings. Here's a clip from the trailer.
Twitter changed the game because if there wasn't that one tweet...
So I hear that the Seattle Kings is officially a done deal. The Maloofs finally sold the ailing Sacramento team.
I looked at it and said, who the hell is this person? Dana Falk's a food blogger. What is this, a scam?
Wait, who? She's not connected to Sacramento or Seattle in any way. How would she know?
We found out that we have this NBA death sentence from a food blogger.
It went from game over to game on.
Well, since then, obviously so much has changed. We now have a downtown arena. The team is finally on the rise and a playoff contender, but the road here was very tough. Joining us today are KCRA sports anchor Michelle Dapper and KCRA investigative producer Dave Manicheri to tell us more about Game On, Fight for the Kings. Hey, you two. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
I have to say, when watching the documentary, I had to keep reminding myself, the Kings are here. You know, there's so much suspense. And it was a decade ago. Why decide to unpack all of this and revisit this story?
Well, it's been 10 years. I mean, it's sort of an anniversary. It'd be easy to say it was because of the playoff run, but we actually were working on this prior to the season starting. It was just we saw that it had been a decade, and you know, KCRA, we've been doing more of these sort of documentary features, and so we decided we hadn't done a sports documentary. It was time, and there was nobody else to choose but Michelle. Then she was perfectly situated because she had started. She was up in Seattle before, or in Washington before she came down to Sacramento. So she had all the contacts in both cities.
Yeah, for me, it's kind of like a full circle moment because I did cover this saga up in Washington, and it was, you know, 10 years ago. You would ask anyone in Seattle or anywhere in Washington, the Sonics were back, and for me, I took the Sacramento job at KCRA, you know, a few months later. So for me, it was like bang bang covering this saga from two different sides of the coin, and man, I can't believe it's been 10 years. It went by fast.
It really did, and it's easy to forget the whirlwind that was really 4 months in 2013, you know, now that we're in 2023. Dave, can you give us like the Cliff Notes version of why the Maloofs were looking to sell the Kings?
It was a financial decision. And I mean, it's one of the things people don't think about, the fact that, I mean, it's a business. We like to think of it as our Kings, right? You know, the fans go, this is our team. But at the end of the day, it was the Maloofs' team. So if you look at what was going on in that era, their hotel in Vegas, the Palms, wasn't doing well. They had sold the alcohol distribution company that their father had started. It was like you could start to see the funds hemorrhaging. But prior to that, there were a lot of false starts before the 2013 sort of Seattle one that was like the pinnacle of it. But there were a couple of false starts, Anaheim, Virginia Beach. Yeah. So that had happened prior to that. So the writing was kind of on the wall, but it had never quite happened. So I think everybody thought, it's not going to happen again, until suddenly it was like, no, the deal's done and they're going to Seattle.
Okay.
So we actually talked to the Maloofs. They're not included in the documentary, but we had a phone conversation with them, and you know, they're actually, you know, they're still Kings fans. They knew everything about the Kings, the playoff run. But again, at the bottom line, they said for them, it was a business decision.
I want to go back to when you were reporting in Washington 10 years ago. That one tweet from literally a food blogger. Is like the craziest thing, especially when you look back. Take us back to how all of this unfolded.
Well, at that time, you know, Twitter was starting to take off, and very rarely did you have a tweet like that broke a story. He's like, we got to get this fact checked. Is this real? Like, what's going on? And then you see her Twitter handle, and it's like, who is this lady? And then, of course, you dig deeper, and then you find out that she's the daughter of a prestigious NBA agent who had Michael Jordan as a client. And then you think, oh, okay, maybe there's some legs to this. This might be a real thing. And whether or not, you know, as you'll find out, you know, whether or not the Seattle group actually wanted that tweet to come out, I think, but that tweet benefited Sacramento in a lot of ways because it got the ball rolling to say, hey, we need to step in now or we're losing this team.
Yeah, because you have then Mayor Kevin Johnson, who also played in the NBA. I mean, he really sprung into action. I mean, Dave, talk to us about how instrumental he was in keeping the Kings in Sacramento.
Very instrumental. I mean, you brought it up, the NBA, having played with the NBA, but he also had contacts with the business community. He could make a phone call directly to David Stern and talk. So it was kind of one of those things. It was, you know, we've had this discussion throughout the whole production process. If all of these players were not in place, Kevin Johnson was probably the linchpin, but you remove any of the other players, you remove the folks that went to the city council meetings, the Carmichael Dave taking his RV, all the way to Daryl Steinberg being pro tem, any of those pieces go away, this deal falls apart.
And you got to give credit to the Sacramento Kings fans, you know, packing, you know, being out in front of the St. Regis Hotel and chanting and showing that support, going to the city council meetings. That stuff is all the Twitter movement of the hashtag Here We Stay. That was really one of the first revolutionary movements on Twitter as far as trying to keep and rally to keep a team.
Yeah. As you were following this as a sports reporter, Michelle, I mean, how close did Sacramento come to losing the team?
The vibe up there was the Sonics were back. I mean, I remember the day, and it was like, wait, what? the Sonics aren't coming, the Kings are staying? Like, what happened? I just remember that feeling of like, whoa, did Seattle just get blindsided in a lot of ways? And in a lot of ways they did.
Yeah,
because of that perfect storm and that perfect cast of characters that were able to come together and rally together to keep the Kings.
Yeah,
because
they went through that hardship in 2008, losing their team. And so they were hopeful that
yes.
they were going to get a new NBA team, and it just fell
it's
through.
It's funny. They while we have David Stern Parkway or walkway here in Sacramento, they said that they would have named David Stern as a sewage plant. So that is their feeling up there with David Stern. He's not well-liked.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio, and we're talking to KCRA sports anchor Michelle Dapper and investigative producer Dave Manicheri about their new documentary called Game On, Fight for the Kings. It'll air Sunday night on KCRA. Okay, the arena issue is tethered to the Sacramento Kings staying here. That's why we have Golden One Center. And as we were talking about, I mean, that was also a very tough hurdle for Sacramento to just agree on mm-hmm. where it's going to go. Can you unpack that dynamic that was unfolding over the span of a very short time? We're talking like 4 months.
It was difficult because the arena discussion had gone back and forth. Arco, later Sleep Train, Power Balance, whatever everybody calls it, Arco. Arco was falling apart. It was the ceiling was coming down. There were all kinds of issues with it. The NBA was not going to let the team stay if they didn't have a new arena. And we found out in our reporting that, you know, David Stern literally was like, we're not letting you keep the team unless it's not just a new arena. It's a new arena in downtown. And having to do that required a lot of like speed work yeah. just to get it through. And there were a couple groups, Stop and Ion Sacramento, who had valid arguments. They didn't want taxpayers to have to pay for the arena at that point. So there was a battle. So as they were fighting to keep the team and fighting to find people who could pay for it, they also had to go through all of the environmental processes, the remediation of the downtown mall, which was all but vacant at that point. It was literally a battle on two fronts for Sacramento, and the arena was like one of the biggest parts of it, because if they didn't get that done, David Stern called, you know, to make sure that would happen. If that arena didn't happen, the Sonics were back because they had an arena deal already set in Seattle.
Yeah. Let's take a listen to part of the doc.
The arena would be the only infill development of its kind in Sacramento.
The way it was told to me through the city council and even the NBA that optics were very important in there. Because everybody came in with Kings jerseys, then the opposition could say, well, let the Kings fans pay for it, let the Kings owners pay for it, we shouldn't have to.
The opposition was not anti-sports, I mean, a few, but basically it was principled opposition to taxpayers and residents being saddled with a massive amount of debt to line the pockets of billionaires.
The confidence level here was high because the mayor and the city council had already signed off on the deal, the land was already put in place, the NBA was already saying all the right things about Seattle and trying to make the market more welcoming to the NBA again after everything that had happened in 2008.
I mean, you just hear that drama. I mean, that is a lift mm-hmm. in and of itself. But mm-hmm. also Vivek Ranadive, he also had to sell the NBA on his vision for a downtown arena. So we're going to listen to a clip of him describing, you know, a sexy Golden One Center, and then we'll unpack it.
The night before the meeting, they, you know, showed me this big board with a beautiful picture of the arena. And I looked at it and I said, you know, just like, sex it up a little bit, you know? More glass, more purple, you know, just make it look space age. You know, make it look iconic, you know, give me something sexy. David Stern, like, he knows everything. He came and he wagged his finger at me and he said, Ranadive, I know you put that picture together last night. So he knows everything, you know? So I don't know how he knew that.
That took me back to the opening of Golden One Center. I was reporting on mm-hmm. it at KCRA. You were too. I interviewed Vivek Ranadive. And you take a look at what Golden One Center is now, and you pair that with the hindsight of the vision that he had.
Yeah. And one thing, credit to the Kings, the one thing that they've always done is they try to be pioneers and kind of like think outside the box and be innovative as part of that franchise. And when you hear Vivek say, sex it up, I mean, it's just so funny because, you know, if you know Vivek, it's like, okay, Vivek. But they sexed it up and look at it now.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone calls it the catalyst of downtown, and it's there.
And it goes beyond just really nice, sexy renderings. Dave, I mean, it's also good to know people in the legislature, and you dive into that as well. What role did the state legislature play?
It was key. In fact, the folks in Seattle, I think we have a soundbite in the documentary where the folks in Seattle say it really worked in Sacramento's favor mm-hmm. to have the state legislature right there. It also worked in their favor to have Daryl Steinberg as the pro tem. At the time, he was the most powerful man in the state legislature. And so to have the ability to put those laws through to help speed up the process for that arena, again, it was one of the key factors that helped keep the team in town. If they didn't have the legislature and backing Steinberg, who was pushing those bills, it would never have happened. It really wouldn't have.
Yeah, and it's important to also kind of underscore that there wasn't necessarily a consensus among fans or residents. I mean, fans were kind of split over where they wanted the arena. And then you talk about Ion Sacramento. I mean, that's kind of an investigative arm of Sacramento residents who were very critical of the financial priorities that the city had.
Well, absolutely. And especially the parking revenue that was going to be how the city was going to pay for it. And nobody predicted a pandemic. And we don't go into this in the documentary, but it's true. I mean, nobody predicted that the pandemic was going to basically shut down the city. And so both the arena side and the city side didn't have the money to sort of back the bonds that they still have. They're just kind of getting back into shape. But it was. Ion Sacramento really delved into it. They issued a report. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's, you know, you've got both sides sort of looking at what are they going to do. At the end of the day, the arena got built. And even the folks at Ion Sacramento don't dispute that it's a beautiful building and it's a good thing to have right down there. How beneficial it has been in sort of the predictions that started back in 2013 versus what we have today, that's up for viewers to decide.
Yeah, absolutely.
What I love about the documentary is that obviously if you're a Sacramento Kings fan, like you're here for it, right? Like let's mm-hmm. go down a very difficult, dramatic trip down memory lane. But you don't have to be a sports fan. I mean, this is very much like a kind of an investigative documentary that y'all put together. Michelle, from a sports perspective, when you completed the documentary, did you learn more about the team and the ownership and the dynamics that you didn't really know before you started?
It's funny because I obviously know this city loves the Kings. I mean, that's no secret. The fan base is so passionate. And I knew the cast of characters that were involved, but I didn't know, especially like with Steinberg, I didn't know that all the, you know, the urgency that this had to get passed and done and the way they went about it and the local support as well from local investors that stepped up. You know, you got Phil Oates, you got Kevin Nagel. There's a lot of things that I didn't know there. I had seen previous documentaries done on this topic before. So I coming into it, I guess for this project, I knew about that. But before moving to Sacramento, I did not. And so I think that's where I learned, okay, this is why Sacramento kept the Kings.
Yeah. And Dave, from an investigative journalist perspective, you know, you're taking a critical lens at this. What did you learn? What surprised you? Because you've also been in Sacramento for many, many years.
Sure. And I was at KCRA covering this when it sort of unfolded. There was a lot that we didn't know, how involved David Stern was in sort of the machinations of keeping the team in town. There were a lot of things that we go into in the documentary that I did not know, and I don't think most of the city even knows, that went on behind the scenes that sort of reinforces Seattle's view of David Stern. Mm-hmm. But I think most mm-hmm. people don't know how hard he was pushing to keep the team in town. And on top of that, just all of the for us, it was sort of the perfect sort of melding because Michelle knew the sports side and I did the specials project stuff. So we had a great idea of trying to tell this story from the perspective of both cities.
Absolutely.
And so that helps to, I mean, I don't think anybody really knew the Seattle side of things. We sent reporters up there, but But without like sitting down for like, you know, a couple hours with each of these people, you don't really get an idea of, you know, and how they looked at it. And the fact that like Sacramento doesn't hate Seattle and Seattle doesn't hate Sacramento, they actually ended up.
There's friendships that were made.
Absolutely.
And throughout the whole process. I mean, you know, you have one character that's actually friends to this day with another character on the other side. And it's just it was a fun thing for me. I've been in TV 20 plus years now, and this is by far one of my most favorite projects I've done.
I really love that piece of going and getting Seattle's perspective, mm-hmm. because, you know, this journey can be very insular, you know, it can feel very Sacramento, but that's not the case. I mean, what the Sacramento got to keep with the Kings, Seattle lost, and right. Seattle still doesn't have a team. I mean, when you look back on that moment of when, you know, they're going to stay in Sacramento, I mean, what do you think that meant to Seattle even today?
I look back and I don't think Seattle ever really wanted to take the Sacramento Kings because they had it done to them. So they know what it felt like. But at the end of the day, if you know, it's kind of like back to the whole saying of it's business. And if it's business and we're going to get a team, we're going to fully support that team. And it's sad because I do think Seattle did, you know, get their heart ripped out twice, not just once, but, you know, twice. And if you talk to a lot of the Sonics fans to this day up there, they're very hesitant on, you know, the NBA expansion rumors have already started, and the two cities that have been named are Vegas and Seattle. And many Sonics fans are very, like, hesitant to get on that train and say, oh, they're going to come, because I think they're going to wait until, as one of the fellows says in the documentary, you got to have steel in the ground before you're going to believe it. And in a lot of ways, I think there's a lot of parallels between these two cities. I mean, in a lot of ways, you know, things can be said with steel in the ground. Okay, Sacramento has felt that too with the soccer team. So there's a lot of correlation and a little similarities between the two cities on the left coast.
I know both of you are probably, you know, letting out a big sigh of relief. You guys have done a lot of work, but have you already started thinking about a part two and what that could be?
Part two.
What you would like it to be?
We hadn't. it was just getting to the point of getting
just
here.
Just giving you another assignment.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah. No, we hadn't. I mean, I guess, you know, if we were going to do another part two, it would be, especially depending on how this season goes, it'd be looking at, you know, where they went after the team kind of got here. Because, you know, we have it sort of in the trailer, too. It's just like, you know, they just lost again and again and again and again for, you know, 17 years, 16 seasons.
Yeah.
So it's just, and so, you know, it's easy. I've heard some people talk about, you know, oh, it was a terrible ending to the season. But if you look at the years that they struggled, this last season was spectacular for them.
It was remarkable. So it
set them up for this year. So.
Yeah. And they're celebrating their 100th anniversary of their franchise. Of course, that includes, you know, Kansas City and Rochester and elsewhere. Omaha for a bit.
I went and saw the Kings when I was a little kid in Omaha.
I vote going back the whole century for part two.
There we go.
Oh, we did.
Well, thank you so much, Dave and Michelle.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Great job. It's a wonderful documentary. Dave Manucherry is an investigative producer at KCRA. Michelle Dapper is a sports anchor there. You can watch their documentary, Game On, Fight for the Kings, this Sunday night on KCRA. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It is the best time of year here in Sacramento. The weather is starting to cool, the leaves are starting to turn, and if you love good food, there are food festivals. There's a lot to take in, from Oktoberfest celebrations, the Armenian Food Festival, the Serbian Food Festival, not to mention local harvest festivals, Apple Hill, and then, of course, the one and only Greek Food Festival. This Friday kicks off 3 days of food, drinks, desserts, music, dancing, lots of performances at the Greek Orthodox Church in Sacramento. And this year, the Greek community is celebrating a big milestone, 60 years. Joining us to tell us all about this weekend's Greek Fest are two volunteers, Koula Giannoulias and Julie Mamalis. Welcome to you both. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
60 years. This is wonderful. I mean, taking a trip down memory lane, I want to just start off from just what makes the Greek Fest so special and so inviting. Cool, I'll start with you.
Well, let's start with the food. I think that really draws people in. People always ask me, where can I get good Greek food in town? And this is it. We have authentic recipes from our volunteers. Many of them were born in Greece. Some were raised in Greece. And then they pass those recipes down. So we have delicious, you know, Grecian chicken and lamb chops, and not to mention the pastries that are made with a lot of butter and honey and love. So I think the food draws people in. And I also hope it's the hospitality. Julie and I, you know, have been volunteers there a long time. We put our heart and soul into this, and we truly welcome people to the Greek Fest as if it is our home, as if it is a party that we're hosting. So it's very similar to the parties in the Greek villages of Greece in the center of town. And I think the fun, the food, and the hospitality is what keeps them coming back year after year.
Yeah, I have been. I went last year as well. And the food, of course, is amazing, but it's really just such a warm, welcoming environment. For everyone. Julie, I mean, you've been part of the Sacramento Greek community for quite some time.
I have. Came to Sacramento as an infant, so I grew up in the church and all the beauty that came with it.
Yeah. When you take a look back at the Greek Fest, you know, 60 years now, how do you reflect on why it's so special?
You know, Koula mentioned Greek hospitality, I think, is part of it. Greek people are proud to share in their food, in their music, in their culture. We have a very rich culture. And I think sharing that is part of what we love to do.
And you've been volunteering since 1963?
Well, yeah, pretty much. 1963, I had infant children and was bringing them along, and I danced in a fledgling dance group that did performances. Very basic, simple compared to how things are today. We've come a long way, and it's just a prideful thing to be able to take part.
It must also be so meaningful to see, you know, generation after generation take part in the Greek festival.
Yes, Julie's children and grandchildren, I see them.
Three generations.
Yes, yeah. Coming to the church, maybe four generations soon, we hope. Of course, every Greek yaya hopes for that. And if you were to go down to the kitchen right now, I mean, there are a lot of Greeks helping out, and it'll be yaya, you know, the grandmother, papu, the grandfather, and then their kids, grandkids, and even the little ones are coming around. So it is so special to have all those generations. Our most senior volunteer is 95 years old. She's been there since the beginning. She still helps with the pastry. So we're committed. It's usually a lifelong commitment for the Greeks.
And it does take like a Sacramento Greek village to put this together. You have like 400 volunteers that are working very hard this week. Can you peel back the curtain and let us know just kind of what they're doing right now, the hard work that they're doing to put on a great festival?
Well, the kitchen is a buzz. We had thousands of people, so just the kitchen is an amazing place where we produce wonderful things. We're blessed with people in our community who all have different talents. Mm-hmm. We have artists whose artwork you will see on display. We have a wonderful church choir. We will be doing a mini concert on Saturday and Sunday in the church. Presenting beautiful Greek hymns. There's nothing more beautiful than Byzantine hymnology. And we will be preceded by our priest talking a little bit about the Orthodox faith, answering questions that people may have. So I think we try to cover pretty much all aspects of Greece from the beginning, ancient Greece. We have beautiful Greek, we have beautiful ancient panels that it's a depiction of ancient Greece. And one of our wonderful artists, a couple of artists, created these panels. We use them year after year. I personally do a museum. It's a pictorial, informational items also are on display. It's a prideful thing.
Yeah. I mean, you just said you're welcoming or planning to welcome like thousands of people this weekend. I mean, I go back to like the first year of the Greek Fest, and I can only imagine how much it's grown over the last six decades. Why do you think it has stood the test of time?
And we really don't take that for granted because we know of other festivals that have not made it. So to stand here 60 years later, we are incredibly grateful to the community for that. And that's part of our theme this weekend is expressing that gratitude. I do think it's the food. We have great food, but I think it's the commitment of our volunteers and then just the atmosphere. People come out and they get carried away. People who don't dance get out there. They've had a little ouzo. They're on the dance floor and they stay from morning until evening. It's beautiful now out on the grounds across from McKinley Park. So I do think it's that taste of that amazing travel to the Greek islands. Not all of us are able to do that. So you can enjoy that for one weekend.
Are you feeling that it's like the 60th anniversary or is this just another Greek Fest for the two of you?
60 years flew by. Absolutely flew by. We went from a one day, very simple festival. And I think with every passing year, we add a little. We make improvements. We see what needs improving, what maybe needs to be taken off. It's just a work in progress. I think we never feel like we've finished.
Yeah.
I think we're always trying to perfect it.
In the last few minutes that we have, I'm curious, okay, if you're a first timer and you're like, I'm going to be going to the Greek Fest this weekend, give us some your top three like must try foods. Where should they head first?
I would say gyro. I love a gyro. Yeah. We have a very authentic and committed gyro team. I mean, they battle over the tzatziki sauce. They battle over the recipe. Greeks are very passionate. So that's how you know it'll be good. At the bar, we're serving the Greek lemon blast. It's our new signature cocktail. So I would pop by. Or if you know, if you don't drink, we have these imported sodas that are delicious. And I love loukoumades, these fried honey-drenched dough balls. They're like little mini donuts, and they're made fresh on site. So I would say line up for loukoumades. What about you, Julie?
You know, I love the evening hours at the festival. I love our patio area with the lights. It feels very much like being in Greece. We have everything but the seaside. I think everything's there. It's especially beautiful to see the church stained glass windows at night. The light emanating from the church, it's like looking at a gigantic mural. That's absolutely beautiful. So my favorite time is the evening hours and sitting out on the platea, the patio, with all the beautiful umbrella. Very Greek-like. It has a very authentic Greek feeling.
That's wonderful. And especially, I would think, during sunset, too, would be beautiful.
Live music, performances, and we do free Greek dance lessons. Oh, you can come out and learn how to do it. And, you know,
it's just a lot of fun. Yeah.
Logistically, parking can be tricky. Off Alhambra Boulevard, do you have any advice?
Yes, we have free shuttles. So if you go to our website, sacramentogreekfestival.com, you can get all of the remote parking lots and then the free parking shuttle information. If you live in East Sac, walk over, ride your bike. But that is always a challenge, although it's such a great, fun, vibrant area. We hope you'll be patient with us on that and enjoy it once you get in the ground.
Well, it's clearly not turning people away if you're going to be welcoming thousands of people this weekend. You know, finally, at the heart of this, I mean, proceeds are going to benefit charities in the community, Kula. I mean, who are some of these charities that will benefit from this festival?
Every year we pick a different charity, and it's usually a children's related charity. We've done things with Shriners and the Children's Receiving Home. Those are two that we've always supported. And then we also operate our church operations, which many of them are focused on giving back to our local community. Many of them, again, focused on children's aspect. So it is a 100% volunteer. Everything goes back to our charitable operations and a contribution to a local charity as well.
Well, Kula and Julie, thank you so much. Thank you for all the hard work.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
See you there.
For a great time. That is Kula Giannoulias and Julie Mamoulis, the volunteers.
Very good.
Thank you. Volunteers with the Sacramento Greek Food Festival. And you can find all of the information on the Greek Food Fest this weekend, capradio.org/insight. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Claire Morgan and Chris Hagen. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.